The following is a presentation of VBR. Welcome, and thank you for joining us in our study of God's Holy Word.
Welcome back to our study of 1 Timothy. We're in chapter 2. Looking at the concepts expressed in verses 9 and 10, we had gotten down to verse 10 in the previous segment, but I'd like to linger on this subject of modest dress just a little bit longer, because invariably when this subject is discussed or contemplated, one of the questions arises is, how much clothing is necessary in order to be modest? Which in my mind really has to do with the subject of nakedness, biblically defined. We know that God does not view nakedness favorably. In Revelation chapter 3, verse 18, Jesus says to the church at Laodicea, "I counsel you to buy from me white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed." Now, he speaks there of spiritual nakedness, but the principle applies. There's shame when there is nakedness. Revelation chapter 16, verse 15, Jesus says, "Behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame." Adam and Eve realized they were naked after they had eaten of the fruit, and God made them tunics of skin to cover that nakedness. Tunics of skin. Where did he get that skin? We don't know for sure. There are animals who naturally shed. But it seems very possible that God actually killed an animal to provide clothing for Adam and Eve. And if that's the case, that's pretty a powerful thing. A God who had up until that time brought only life, now brought about death in order to clothe his creation that now realized it was naked. Nakedness is made synonymous with shame. And the words for shame in Revelation 3:18 and Revelation 16:15 are different in the Greek, but they mean disgrace and indecency. God does not want us to be naked, be it spiritually or physically, under normal circumstances. But just what constitutes nakedness? When the Bible uses the word naked, is it a synonym for nudity? It would not appear to be so. In Genesis chapter 3, after Adam and Eve had eaten of the fruit and realized they were naked, we read that they made coverings for themselves from fig leaves. The King James uses the word aprons. Again, this is Genesis chapter 3, verse 7. These garments were so small, they covered only what we teach our children are the private parts. Gesenius, a Hebrew scholar, tells us the word for coverings literally means a girdle, a belt. It was just the smallest amount. It was enough to cover the private parts. But dressed this way, even Adam still regarded himself as naked. It's interesting. When God came into the garden after they had eaten of the fruit and was looking for them and said, "Where are you?" Adam said to him in Genesis chapter 3, verse 10, "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." Even though Adam had covered himself to some degree, he still realized that clothing was not enough. So after the dialogue between God and Satan, God and Adam and Eve, and the curses pronounced on them as well as on Satan, we learn in Genesis 3:21 that God gave Adam and Eve new kinds of clothing, which I mentioned just a moment ago. And the New King James calls this type of clothing that God gave them tunics. Tunics of skin, or the King James says coats of skin. Now, whatever these were, we can be certain that this was enough clothing to satisfy God. What kind of clothing was it? How much did it cover? The Hebrew word for tunic or coat in this verse is defined as follows by the various Hebrew sources I have consulted. If you look in Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, he says the word means to cover, and he calls it a shirt, but not just any shirt. He says that the King James translators rendered this word coat, garment, or robe. Gesenius tells us that this word referred to a garment that was generally with sleeves coming down to the knees. Wilson's Old Testament Word Studies defines the garment as covering from the shoulder to the knee. Brown Driver Briggs, an esteemed Hebrew source, tells us that the word means a tunic, an undergarment, a long shirt-like garment, usually of linen. Notice, a long shirt-like garment. Alfred Rubens, in his book, A History of Jewish Costume, says this: it was a shirt-like garment with long or short sleeves and came down below the knees. There's a consistent testimony here that this tunic, this coat, as the King James says, was a long garment stretching from the neck to the knee. This is the word that Moses used to describe Joseph's coat of many colors, Genesis chapter 37, verse 3. And it was a garment, interestingly, that God gave to Adam and to Eve, to both of them, male and female. The idea that a man needs less covering than a woman seems to be a man-made idea, as it's not borne out in Scripture. God clothed both of them the same, and we can be sure that what He gave them satisfied Him. Do we have any other biblical evidence to go on? Exodus chapter 20, verse 26. When God was commanding the nation of Israel how to handle worshiping Him, He said the following: "Nor shall you go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed on it." It was customary in ancient times for them to put the altar to their gods or to God up high, and there would be steps leading up to the altar. But God said, you're not going to build my altar that way. And the reason for it is so that no one's nakedness gets exposed. Now, granted, this doesn't give us a lot of certain information, but if we think about it, the steps would have to be pretty high, and the onlooker would have to be pretty close to the steps before anything that in modern day language that would be regarded as nakedness would be seen. It's interesting. Just gives us a little bit of information, kind of a general idea. We get something a little more specific in Exodus 28. Exodus chapter 28, verse 42, God is describing through Moses the kind of clothing that the priests were to wear. And we read the following, Exodus 28, 42. The priests were to wear linen trousers to cover their nakedness. They shall reach from the waist to the thighs. The priest was to wear this garment called trousers, or your King James says breeches, and it was to cover from the waist to the thighs in order to cover their nakedness. Now, we need to think about that just a little bit. If we take from the waist to the thighs, just literally, this would have a garment that hardly covers anything, because, of course, the thigh begins not very long after the waist, and we've already seen that that kind of clothing was not sufficient. It was regarded as nakedness by Adam, and it was improved upon by God when He gave them the coats of skin. So what does this mean? What does it mean that it went from the waist to the thighs? Well, I'll offer what some of scholars say. It's not gospel, but this is their understanding of it. The pulpit commentary tells us that this meant the garment reached from the waist to a little above the knee. In other words, to the thigh would mean to cover most or all of the thigh. James Strong, the one who put together Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, wrote a book entitled The Tabernacle of Israel, and he had this to say. They, that is these trousers or breeches, reached, quote, from the loins as far as the thighs. That's the literal Hebrew. Which must mean, he writes, that they entirely covered both these parts. That is, they went to the knee and necessarily enough below this to fasten securely and comfortably. I looked at a lot of translations to see if they would offer any indication of what they thought the Hebrew expression might mean, and I found only one translation that deviated in any significant way at all from the way the New King James translates it. It's the Bible in Basic English, and it simply translated it this way: from the middle to the knee. The only source of all that I consulted that provided a more liberal view of these garments of the priests was Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who said that this meant it reached halfway down the thighs, but they said they based this opinion on Egyptian art. I don't want to put my faith in the words of men, but there does seem to be a possible principle here. When God clothed Adam and Eve, He appears to have given them a garment that covered all of their torso and the upper part of their leg, down to about the knee at the very least. The same seems to have been true for the garments that the Lord wanted the priests to wear. And this would fit with the stairs going up to an altar, if you got very far, you would start to see something much above the knee, which in God's view seems like it might be nakedness. At the very least, we need to take this subject more seriously than do our modern counterparts, and perhaps take a better safe than sorry route. Whatever the case, let the sisters and the brothers alike be driven by the desire, as he said in verse 9, to not do anything that would bring shame upon them before God, and to do what shows that self-control and good judgment is the thing guiding how we dress. Back now directly to the text of 1 Timothy. Paul has talked about the brothers praying and how they're to do it when the church is assembled. He has talked about how the sisters are to dress when they come into the assembly. Now he has some other instructions, and so let's pick up in verse 11, and let's read verses 11 and 12 together. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission, and I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Let's continue on the next two verses. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. The beginning of verse 11, Paul says, let a woman learn in silence with all submission. We have a parallel passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 34. In 1 Corinthians 14, 34, Paul writes, let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. If you create a chart comparing the first part of 1 Corinthians 14, 34 with the first part of 1 Timothy 2, 11, and the last part of 1 Corinthians 14, 34 with the last part of 1 Timothy 2, 11, you find that these passages are parallel. The only significant difference between the passages is that in 1 Corinthians 14, 34, Paul offers a little more explanation. He says they're to be silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak. And concerning submission, he says, as the law also says. But apart from the extra explanation, the commands are exactly the same, and they're in the exact same order. In 1 Corinthians 14, Paul's clearly talking about when the church comes together. Starting in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 17, he began to address when the church comes together on the Lord's Day for the Lord's Supper, for singing and teaching. And all the way through to chapter 14, he continues to discuss that context. And it's in that context that he gives this divine prohibition for sisters to allow the brothers to do the talking in that setting. We'll talk more about that in just a moment, God permitting. But it's important, I think, to notice that 1 Timothy 2:11 and 1 Corinthians 14:34 are parallel verses, parallel commands concerning the same context. That is, when brethren are in church, which fits with everything we've seen thus far, beginning in chapter 2, 1 Timothy 2, verse 8. Now, while they're in church, Paul says that she is to be silent. She is to learn in silence. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to go back to the parallel passage and start there and move from 1 Corinthians 14 to 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11. In 1 Corinthians 14, 34, Paul said that the women were to keep silence in the churches. The Greek word that Paul used in 1 Corinthians 14, 34 is the word sagao, S-I-G-A-O. It's 4601 in your Strong's Exhaustive Concordance. And in Bauer, Danker, Art, and Gingrich, the most highly respected Greek lexicon of our day, here is how they define that word. Definition number one, to be silent. Say nothing, keep still, keep silent. And they cite that as being the meaning in 1 Corinthians 14:28 and in 1 Corinthians 14:34. They also say it means simply to stop speaking and become silent, and they cite 1 Corinthians 14, verse 30. So we have a Greek lexicon, a dictionary which defines words in another language in English, telling us that this word means just exactly what the translators have chosen, that it means silence. We can look at how this word is used elsewhere, however. In Mark chapter 14, verses 60 and 61, as Jesus stood before the high priest the night he was betrayed, we read the following. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But he kept silent and answered nothing. That's this Greek word sagao from 1 Corinthians 14:34. In Luke 19:40, as Jesus was entering Jerusalem the week before he would be crucified, it says, he answered and said to them, those who had told him to tell people to stop praising him as they were, he answered and said to them, I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out. That is, if these should stop speaking what they are, then the stones themselves would do it. So we have what the lexicon tells us the word means, an uninspired source, but we rely on these when we're looking into words outside of our own language. But we have how this word is used elsewhere in the Bible, where it's clearly speaking of silence. And then contextually in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, we see that the word speaks to silence. In 1 Corinthians 14, verse 28, Paul talks about what someone who has the gift of tongues should do if he does not have the gift of interpretation or there's no one to interpret it. He says that even though they're able to do this, they should do it to God and they should not speak in the assembly. They should be silent until there's an interpreter. In verse 30, he speaks to the prophets and says, if while one is prophesying to the church, another one should be inspired, then the one who is speaking should stop and be silent and let the other speak. This is the same word that appears in 1 Corinthians 14:34. So when Paul comes to 1 Corinthians 14:34 and says that the sisters are to be silent, they're the third group he has applied that term to in the chapter. Now with that as a framework, we come to 1 Timothy 2:11, where we have this parallel command. Paul uses a different word in 1 Timothy 2:11 and 12 than he does in 1 Corinthians 14:34. And there's a lot that has been made of this by some over the years. The Greek word that's used in 1 Timothy 2:11 is the Greek word hesuchia. It's 2271 in Strong's Exhaustive Concordance. Now, this word could mean a state of quietness without disturbance. In other words, not absolute silence. And it is so used in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 12. However, this word does also mean, depending upon context, silence. Bauer, Denker, Arndt, and Gingrich tell us it means, in 1 Timothy 2:11, a state of saying nothing or very little. And they tell us that a synonym would be silence. Marvin Vincent, in his Word Studies in the New Testament, says the same thing. The word is used in the sense of silence. Why did Paul use two different words? I can't answer that question. I do know we do the same thing in our own day and age. I might say to my children or to someone, stop, but then I might say in a minute or two later, halt. I've said the same thing with two different words. We do that, and Paul seems to be doing that here. And one of the things that helped me come to the conclusion that even though a different word is used, it must be meaning the same thing, was first of all, the two commands are parallel, 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2. The parallelism was a strong point in favor of that interpretation, I believe. But also when I discovered what Luke did in the book of Acts with these two words. And if you want to turn there with me, I'm going to go to Acts chapter 21. At the end of Acts chapter 21, Paul has been beaten up by the crowd in Jerusalem in the temple court. The Roman soldiers had taken him and they were marching him into the barracks, but he wanted the opportunity to speak to the crowd. And so he asked the commander if he could speak to the people, and the commander granted him the opportunity. And so here is a beaten and battered Paul in Acts chapter 21, verse 40, standing on the stairs that were leading up into the barracks and getting ready to speak to the crowd. We read the following, Acts 21, verse 40. So when he had given him permission, that is when the commander had given Paul permission, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew language. Now, the word for silence there is a noun form of the word in 1 Corinthians 14. So there was a great silence when Paul began to speak to them. Now, with that in mind, let's keep reading. Chapter 22, verse 1. Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now. And when he heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. We've all probably had that experience where you're in a crowd and there's something going on up in front, and people are listening, but they're still kind of shuffling around. Maybe there's shuffling of papers. Maybe there are people whispering to each other. And so they're being silent insofar as speaking to the crowd or competing with whoever's up front, but it's not so silent that you could hear a pin drop. But then something begins to happen up front, and everyone becomes all the more silent. And that's what's being described here. When Paul spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they got really quiet. You could hear a pin drop. Now, why is that significant? Because the word for all the more silent in chapter 22, verse 4, is the same word Paul uses in 1 Timothy 2:11. The word that has been thought by some to be less strong than the word in 1 Corinthians 14. In this case, it's actually the one used to describe greater silence. The point of all of this being 1 Corinthians 14:34 and 1 Timothy 2:11 are parallel passages. They're both speaking to what the Lord wants of the sisters when the church is assembled on the Lord's day for the Lord's Supper, for singing, and for teaching. My understanding of this is this is a different context than our Bible classes, than home Bible studies. This prohibition does not apply to those contexts. This is speaking specifically to what Paul calls church in 1 Corinthians 11:17 all the way to 1 Corinthians 14:34 and 35. As an aside, but I think it's a significant aside, if you study those four chapters of 1 Corinthians, starting in chapter 11, verse 17, and going on to the end of chapter 14, seven times you come across the expression, comes together. Paul, in those chapters, is talking about when the church comes together. He's talking about when they come together on the Lord's Day, and he defines what he means by comes together. He says, when you all, the entire congregation, comes together in one place. That's not what we do during our Bible classes. During our Bible classes, we've got some members of the church in one part of the building, some members of the church elsewhere. But we don't all come together into one place until the time we have the Lord's Supper. And he mentions that in 1 Corinthians 11, and he mentions singing in 1 Corinthians 14:26. It's in what, for many of us, is that second hour of our gathering on Sunday. That's church, defined by the Apostle Paul. And that's the setting for this command we've just read in 1 Timothy 2:11, as well as the one in 1 Corinthians 14. So with all that said, according to Paul, this quiet outer behavior that the sisters choose to practice will be accompanied by and will be in accordance with a decision on their part to submit to the leadership of the brothers. For he says, they are to learn in silence with all submission. The word submission here means just what it sounds like, a state of submissiveness, subjection, subordination. What's going on here? I think it's as simple as this. It is God's design that men serve as the leaders, first in the home and then in the church. The sisters' decision to be submissive honors this part of God's plan, and it actually encourages its realization. It's not that God does not value the understanding and the wisdom that sisters have to offer. It's very possible that in a congregation, all the women could be better Bible students and better communicators of Bible truth than all the men. This has nothing to do with the value of what sisters bring to the table. It has something to do, however, with what God wants from the men. Women consistently score better on tests measuring the ability to communicate verbally or things along those lines. In general, women are just much better communicators in that way, and they're more inclined towards it. If God did not give a prohibition like this, what would men be inclined to do? What might happen? I could see a scenario where God wanted the men to be the leaders. If the floor was given to the sisters, the brothers, to their shame, might just sit back and let them do it. To help the brothers be the leaders they ought to be, God has asked the sisters for this meeting on the Lord's Day to let the brothers do the talking. Even questions, because Paul says, if they have questions, let them ask their own husbands at home, 1 Corinthians 14:35. Here in verse 12 of 1 Timothy 2, Paul says, as he expounds on this, I do not permit a woman to teach. Again, this is for during the church service, the actual assembly of the saints. Certainly a sister may teach outside of it. She may teach other women. Titus chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. She certainly may teach her children as Timothy's mother did for him. She may have Bible studies with lost souls, men included. This is only pertaining to when the church is gathered for the Lord's Day service, for the Lord's Supper singing, and when they're all together in one place. During that time, she's not to be a teacher, and she's also not to have authority over a man. This is one of the things that proves that we're talking about church. A woman may have authority over a man in other contexts. A grown man may still find himself in some respects under the authority of his mother if he's in her home and in connection with his father. But in the Lord's Day service, the Lord wants the men to be the ones exercising authority. One thing we should address before we leave this passage. If you're reading from the King James, it says a woman is not to usurp authority over a man. Over the years, it has been argued that sisters may speak up in the assembly if a brother gives them the floor. Because in doing it that way, they would not be usurping authority. They wouldn't be taking something. They would be just, it would have been given to them. The problem with this is that the authorities who adopt this understanding of the Greek word are nowhere to be found. To my knowledge, the King James translation is the only translation, apart from Living Oracles back from 1830, that uses the word usurp. I may not have that year exactly right for the Living Oracles, but those are the only two translations I know that use this word usurp. All other translations, the NAS, the ESV, the NIV, the NRSV, they all render this a woman is not to exercise authority or have authority. Paul is not saying that if a brother yields the floor to a sister, she may then speak, even though she may have something fantastic to say. That's not his point. His point is that in the assembly, a woman is not to exercise authority at all. That's for the men to do. And following this command, Paul is going to give a rationale and a reason for it. And in our next segment, we'll pick that up with verse 13.